You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's help out there for people at risk of suicide and for their loved ones. An expert joins the show to talk about the scope of the problem and shares a new report about the mental health needs here in Wisconsin. First, the far-right conspiracy group known as QAnon has been gaining in popularity in recent months. What began on fringe message boards a few years ago spread to social media, especially during the pandemic, and it's grown a lot. In fact, the Wall Street Journal reports that one particular QAnon Facebook group increased its membership more than tenfold between January 1st and August 1st of this year. And last month, a QAnon supporter in Georgia named Marjorie Taylor Greene won a Republican primary for Congress. That district has traditionally supported Republicans by wide margins in general elections. After her victory, President Trump tweeted that she's, quote, a future Republican star and is strong on everything and never gives up. Deepa Seetharaman is a reporter who covers social media and politics for the Wall Street Journal. She's been following this story. Deepa, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Can you start with the basics, a nutshell description of what QAnon is and what ideas they've been spreading?
So QAnon is a far right wing, very loosely organized kind of network of different types of beliefs, largely unsubstantiated. So at the center of it is this idea that there are a group of sort of pedophiles, Satan worshiping pedophiles that are largely elite Democrats, journalists, entertainment industry folks, and other mainstream institutional figures that kind of control the world and much of the US government. And that Donald Trump, the president, is trying to challenge them and that they're seeking to undermine him. So it's a conspiracy that believes that, you know, the world is being overrun by kind of criminals and sex traffickers and pedophiles, and that there is only one person in the government who can try to push back, and that's the president.
And the idea, this figure of Q, or supposedly was somebody inside the Trump administration sharing the details of this campaign, right?
Right. And so the whole concept of QAnon, you know, conspiracy theories have been around for obviously a long time, and some of this has its roots well before the last few years. But this particular movement emerged, experts say, it was around October, or, 2017, where somebody who calls himself Q started posting on a kind of fringe social media messaging site called 4chan. And he or she, this person never really identifies themselves, claims to have the highest level of security clearance in the Energy Department for nuclear weapons. That's Q clearance, hence the letter Q. And Anon, because he's anonymous. And he or she will frequently, or they, we don't really understand who the identity of whoever is posting as Q. They, frequently will drop messages that they call Q drops or breadcrumbs that try to highlight something that is happening in the Trump administration, but in a very pro-Trump kind of way. And so there's a lot of experts say, you know, if you remember Pizzagate, which was a kind of conspiracy theory that really gained fame in 2016, it was this idea. There's a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant called Comet Ping Pong, where a man came with an assault rifle and fired a couple shots because he believed that this was the site of a child's sex ring in the basement of this pizzeria, and that was being run by Hillary Clinton and John Podesta. The pizza parlor doesn't have a basement. There's no proof of any kind of child sex ring at all, but the conspiracy just gained so much traction online, and a lot of people started to believe it. QAnon is sort of in that same tradition of believing that the world, especially Democrats, belong to this cabal of pedophiles, and they must be stopped. And there's just no proof of that on a wide scale.
Talking to Deepa Seetharaman from the Wall Street Journal, looking at the rise and spread of the QAnon conspiracy theory. One more point about QAnon, especially in the early days, there were very specific predictions about mass arrests, or that Robert Mueller was actually working not against, but with President Trump, and would on a particular day sometimes be arresting Hillary Clinton and thousands of other people.
Right.
Lots of specific predictions that didn't come true. A lot of people thought that that would be the end of this conspiracy theory. It wasn't. Could you talk about
that? No, it isn't. It, you're right. And I think there were predictions about what Donald Trump would say when he was finally asked about QAnon in a press conference. He was recently asked about QAnon in a press conference, and he didn't say any of the things that were predicted. I mean, what he did say was, you know, I hear they support me, and that's very nice. And, you know, I didn't denounce it. And so, but what has happened, you know, if you watch these groups and the way that they respond to these messages, or when things are off, is to justify them. I mean, after Trump, made his comments about QAnon, a lot of the Facebook and Instagram groups that I follow said, hey guys, you know, if he really didn't believe us, he would have said something completely different. He would have said, you know, QAnon is terrible. Let's celebrate. Let's marinate in this moment. And I think that's something to think about. Like, it almost doesn't matter that these Q drops and breadcrumbs wind up being false, especially around the details. You know, Q gets a lot of things wrong. But the movement has a lot of power, even though it's not rooted in truth, and that continues to sustain it.
Let's give a listen to some of those comments from the president. This was a news conference a few weeks ago when he was asked about QAnon. Here's a listen.
Well, I don't know much about the movement other than I understand they like me very much, which I appreciate. But I don't know much about the movement. I have heard that it is gaining in popularity, and from what I've heard, these are people that, when they watch the streets of Portland, when they watch what happened in New York City in just the last 6 or 7 months, but this was starting even 4 years ago when I came here, almost 4 years, can you believe it? These are people that don't like seeing what's going on in places like Portland and places like Chicago and New York and other cities and states.
In your reporting, you cite some Republicans who very specifically denounced QAnon and the various conspiracies coming out of it. But then in this case, not so much from the president.
No, I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, we saw Representative Adam Kinzinger in Illinois say something. Jeff Flake has said something, you know, that this is a conspiracy, that's conspiracy theory that doesn't have a place in the party. So there are definitely voices within Republican Party who are vocal about their problems with QAnon and think it doesn't deserve a place in the party or platform. And at the same time, there are a lot of congressional candidates for the Republican Party that are QAnon supporters. You know, in Georgia, you have a pretty prominent QAnon supporter in Marjorie Taylor Greene. And, you know, in Colorado, you have Lauren Boebert. I mean, these are people who believe in Q or are sympathetic to its messages. And that's also gaining traction within the party, which is pretty interesting.
And a lot of your reporting has focused, Deepa, on the rise on social media. As you mentioned, this started on some of the fringe, ugliest places on the internet, the 4chans and 8chans of the world. Now it's all over the place in mainstream places like Instagram and Facebook groups. Can you talk about that rise?
Right. I mean, it was pretty clear. This movement quickly jumped from sites like 4chan to places like Facebook groups, specifically Facebook groups. And I think a lot of people have used Facebook groups to find, you know, fellow moms or political supporters or whatever. You know, it's where you find community, which is especially important these days during the pandemic when a lot of us are spending our lives online. But the groups have also been incubators for this movement and allowed people to share unsubstantiated theories with one another and feel confident in their beliefs and not really have those beliefs punctured by anybody else with an opposing opinion. In many cases, it's been a really important place for QAnon to grow and gain traction. And it's something that the companies have been aware of for a while now. I mean, they've only recently started to take some action against it, though, a variety of reasons. One, you know, these companies, especially Facebook, have a bias towards free speech. They want people to communicate. It takes a lot to get them to ban certain types of communication and speech. But also this speech is really tied up in politics, and they don't want to mess with that at all. And so I think there's the companies haven't done as much as they probably could to tamp down this kind of rhetoric and this movement. And as a result of this flourishing online, you see a lot of this activity moving offline, you know, in the form of protests, Save the Children protests. I think a lot of people have seen those, or otherwise. And that it's been, that dynamic is very important to understand.
We're talking about QAnon, the fringe right-wing conspiracy group, a loosely affiliated group. They're growing acceptance online in parts of the country as well. Deepa Seetharaman is a Wall Street Journal reporter, and we're going to focus in a few moments on their influence here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the rise of QAnon? Have you been paying attention to this story? Have you had arguments on one side or another about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on QAnon and its influence on and offline. Deepa Seetharaman stays with us from the Wall Street Journal. You can join in with your experiences, thoughts, and questions at 800-642-1234. I want to bring another guest on now to focus on Wisconsin a little bit. Ricardo Torres is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He worked on a USA Today story about how the group's conspiracy theories are drawing more and more followers, sometimes in person. Ricardo, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What did you find when you looked at QAnon events, even in-person events here in the state?
So I attended a QAnon march a couple of weeks ago on the east side of Milwaukee, not knowing exactly what I was going to run into, how many people were going to be there. And there was about 30 people there, and they were walking through the streets of Milwaukee on the east side, chanting, "Save our children." When I talked to members of the group, they seemed like true believers that that anything that Q says or that Q posts or that, you know, other things that they see on Facebook is real. One of the things that they pointed out that I found that was interesting, they used real cases, real sex abuse cases, like what happened at Penn State with Jerry Sandusky, what happened at Michigan State with Larry Nassar, you know, the Catholic Church sex abuse cases. They point to those cases, those real cases, as evidence that this network of pedophiles exists. And they even, one person mentioned a case that happened in Racine. The mayor at the time in 2009, Gary Becker, was arrested and charged with trying to solicit a child for sex. So they saw that case and said that it's evidence that it's here in Wisconsin.
But no indication that any of those actual cases, which actually happened, are part of this international cabal, they say, of satanic, in some cases, blood-drinking pedophiles. They're taking real cases and attaching it to this framework of the conspiracy, it sounds like?
Right. It's sort of a confirmation bias. They see this stuff, these real cases that happen on the news, and they believe that it's real.
What did you hear from them about how they connect with each other and organize on and offline?
So Facebook is definitely the driver of the group. It's the where they heard that this march was taking place. There's a page, an individual by the name of Scotty the Kid, who apparently was very big on pushing these types of theories, these conspiracy theories, and a lot of the people from Milwaukee were followers of him, and it just kind of snowballed from that. And I do want to say that even though it was about 30 people walking through Milwaukee with signs that said "Save our children," there were people driving by that honked, and so I'm not sure if they read the signs and support the movement and honked, or because there have been so many marches this summer for all sorts of different issues, that, you know, maybe they may have mistaken it for another issue that people were marching for. I'm not sure, but I did notice that there was some honking as they walked through the streets.
Ricardo, thanks a lot for sharing your in-person reporting with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about QAnon. That was Ricardo Torres from the Journal Sentinel. Deepa Sitharaman stays with us from the Wall Street Journal. And let's bring your calls into the story. Laura is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Laura, hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. What did you want to tell us about, Laura?
Well, my son got into QAnon and all this conspiracy theory stuff at the age of 19. He was at a really vulnerable time in his life. And he had a bad breakup with a girl, and he just started believing all this stuff. And it's 10 years later, and he still is trying to convince me of all this pedophilia and all this type of stuff. And it's just really scary because they seem to prey on young men especially and when they're gullible and vulnerable.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. So it sounds like that in some ways definitely would predate QAnon, but in some ways it's morphed into other conspiracy theories. Do we have a sense of, Deepa, who is targeted by an organization or a non-organization like QAnon?
Right. I think we have some sense of it. It's definitely younger people. Especially these days, you know, as Ricardo was mentioning around the whole Save the Children hashtag, it's a lot of young women that are also joining this group, this particular conspiracy theory at the moment. And so these are women, either mothers themselves or you know, just particularly interested in children's issues that have found their way to QAnon through the hashtag. Save the Children is a legitimate organization. It's a real charity. You know, there are celebrities that promote it on social media and use the hashtag Save the Children. And that is something that the QAnon group has kind of glommed onto and appropriated for their own sort of messaging as well. And that's been very fascinating to watch and an interesting dynamic about QAnon. But it's, you know, the listener's right. I mean, it's a lot of young people and a lot of young men. So it's... And conservatives at the moment and Trump supporters. I think that it's a pretty broad group, but within that you can find some themes.
Thanks for sharing your story, Laura. We'll go now to Jacob in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hi. We've talked about fake news in the last election. We know that the Russians are going to be interfering with our country's elections again. This just seems to me like something that they could have planted. Maybe they based it on Dan Brown's books years ago, which is maybe what the woman before me was referring to. But nobody's talking about Russian bots or instigators from that direction.
Jacob, thanks a lot for the call. Deepa, do we have any indication that Russian bots or organizations either helped start QAnon or are acting as amplifiers for it?
So this is an excellent question. When I talked to researchers about this a month ago, there was a strong suspicion that the Russians were somehow behind it, but no concrete proof. There are, though, increasingly researchers that believe that there must be some kind of connection, that there are some themes that you see in QAnon that you know, Russian propagandists also like to deploy. So it's, as I understand it, there's a high likelihood of a connection, but at the moment, none of the researchers I've talked to have firm proof.
Thanks for the call, Jacob. We'll go to Mark in Romance now. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. See, there's really nothing new with the QAnon. QAnon, these types of conspiracies go back to the Elders of Zion, the anti-Semitic publications, but in Nazi Germany, they had the same thing, where they were accusing Jews of being pedophiles, kidnapping children, eating the children, seeking, you know, some kind of life-giving elixir out of the bodies of the children. And I think that people really need to pay attention that this QAnon thing, it's not a freaky, funny thing. It's not an oddball thing. And it will gather more and more people, just as it did in Nazi Germany, and it will provide the justification for really bad things in this country. We are in fascism.
Mark, thanks for the call. People have pointed to what Mark pointed to, that idea of the blood libel that had been used against Jews for actually centuries. What do you think about what Mark had to say, the growing influence being a threat, not just kind of a fringy curiosity, but something that could expand into mainstream society?
Yeah, I think I can't emphasize this point enough. I mean, we've been talking about it as if it's a conspiracy theory, and strictly that's true. But I think when people hear the words conspiracy theory, they think, oh, like a kooky tinfoil wearing hat guy who thinks crazy things, but isn't necessarily, you know, is largely harmless. This isn't that. This is a real movement. There are millions of people who engage with the content on Facebook and Instagram. There's millions of views of QAnon videos and on YouTube. There are QAnon podcasts, and now there are QAnon candidates running for federal office. I think we have to really underscore the fact that this is a movement that has a lot of power and therefore must be understood. And, you know, people, it's going to start affecting our politics and our lives even more intensely than it does today.
And briefly, one expert you talked to said they preferred the phrase online cult.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've heard that. But even, you know, I think a lot of us are struggling with how precisely to describe it. Online cult is pretty good. I've heard it described as a religion. But we're still figuring out the vocabulary.
Deepa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Deepa Sitharaman is a reporter who covers social media and politics at The Wall Street Journal. We talked to her about how the fringe right-wing conspiracy group or online cult or whatever people are calling it, QAnon, is gaining mainstream traction. We also heard from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Ricardo Torres about QAnon's reach here in Wisconsin. Coming up, September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. We'll talk about how suicide has affected Wisconsin and how to help the people in your life who may need support. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Governor Evers is moving ahead to create a commission on redistricting in Wisconsin, while some communities are holding referendums that call for nonpartisan line drawing. Find out more Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and a new report tells us more about how suicide is affecting Wisconsinites. Produced by the Department of Health Services, Mental Health America of Wisconsin, and the Medical College of Wisconsin, it looks at the impact in the state over the last 20 years and outlines different areas of action to help prevent suicide in the years to come. That includes things like building community connections, helping healthcare groups better support people, and doing more to keep track of suicide deaths. A reminder that if you or someone you know is considering suicide, you can call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK, or text HOPELINE to 741-741. Leah Rolando is the Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Leah co-chairs Prevent Suicide Wisconsin, a statewide public-private partnership and advisory body for the Wisconsin State Suicide Prevention Plan. Leah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the impact portion of this report found that from 2000 to 2017, suicide deaths in Wisconsin went up 40%. That sounds pretty alarming in some ways, obviously, but can you put those numbers in context for us?
Yeah. So when you look at the report, you'll see some other key findings right at the beginning when we look at different types of populations. So I just want to make sure folks look at the report and can know that there are some different populations they can look at. But yes, the suicide rate in Wisconsin did increase by 40%, but it is also increasing nationally. So we're not that different from a lot of other states. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be working hard to prevent suicide. So as we know, suicide is complex. You know, some of the reason we might be seeing increasing rates, suicide is getting reported more frequently. So when you're working with medical examiners and coroners, making sure that we're listing suicides. I know sometimes families aren't comfortable with disclosing that a death might have actually been a suicide attempt. So that's a piece of why the reporting might be getting better and the rates look like they're rising, but they are rising, and there are a variety of risk factors that go into that. And then we get into that in some of the response piece of the report. So things more than just mental health issues, when we're looking at economic issues, when we're looking at access to healthcare, oppression in general. So we know specifically Black youth suicide rates are on the rise. So we want to shift the field to actually look at these things that are impacting someone's likelihood to actually attempt suicide. And it's not necessarily just something that's caused by mental illness, like a lot of us, you know, have been saying for such a long time.
We've got the report linked, by the way, at WPR.org/Central Time. Now, that number, that increase, obviously bad news, but in a way, there's a lot of good news in the report, in the sense that it sounds like, if I'm reading it right, there are a lot of things we know. There are a lot of things that we know work to help prevent suicide, to help people from getting to that point in the first place. There are a lot of big and small ways we can make a difference, right?
Absolutely. There are actually 50 opportunities for action in the report, in the response section, that are directly paired with resources that we can use in Wisconsin to prevent suicide. So we're working on a lot of things in all four of those strategies to make sure people in local communities know what that actually looks like on the ground. So we're hoping this is a report that can be accessible to local and tribal health departments, coalitions, healthcare systems, and just people in whatever their role is, to start doing some things to work on suicide prevention in their communities. And a lot of times the things that we're doing are suicide prevention, even if they're not ultimately called suicide prevention. We just had the annual Prevent Suicide Wisconsin conference virtually this week, actually, and one of our keynoters referenced in some Native communities, they've kind of flipped suicide prevention around and called it life promotion. So what are those things that we can do way upstream that make life worth living for specific communities? And what are the things that we can point to that actually decrease the likelihood that folks become suicidal in the first place? So there is a lot of good news in the report. There's a lot of things we can do. And you don't have to be an expert to do any of, well, you know, some of these things are clinical. And so I, you know, of course, we want some mental health professionals to be doing some of these trainings. But my point is, you don't have to be a professional to have a role in preventing suicide.
Talking to Leah Rolando, Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin, talking about a new report on the impact of suicide in the state and ways to provide a better mental health environment, a better community environment that helps prevent suicide and intervene before it happens. Leah, I want to pick up where you left off, talking about what everyday people can do. And I want to get to one point I hear about a lot, the idea of that we're reluctant. We might be reluctant to check in with that person we know is having a hard time, and even raise the idea of if they're thinking about suicide, because we're worried, am I going to put that idea in their head? Am I going to like make it worse by talking to them? How can we approach a situation like that?
Yeah, that is such a good point. I think so many of us, myself included, are really afraid to approach that question, really ask someone, especially people we love. I think the closer you are to someone, the harder it can be sometimes, right? To ask them to start saying, you know, I've noticed you've been having a really hard time, or I know you have so much on your plate right now. If somebody was, you know, if somebody else was in your place, they might be thinking about suicide. They might have thoughts of, you know, death or dying. I'm wondering if you're feeling that way too. And so it's not, the words you say aren't as important as your tone and the fact that you're just sharing that you care about them, and whatever they say is not going to scare you away. You're not going to hit that panic button. You're not going to call a crisis line immediately if they tell you They folks really just want you to be able to sit in the pain with them and hold space for them and talk about how they're feeling and give them the time to do that. So I think a lot of us could just benefit a lot from being patient with ourselves and having some grace around that fear of asking someone, because we know that's absolutely a myth. The myth is that if we ask someone about suicide, it might, you know, cause someone to consider suicide or attempt suicide. We know that's false. We know that the likelihood for someone to attempt suicide, if we ask, actually decreases. Because if I was that person who was thinking about suicide, I would know that the person asking me is okay to hear that answer.
So it's important that we talk about suicide. Something I found interesting in the report, given that I'm in the media, is talking about how we talk about suicide, the phrasing we use when talking about suicide attempts or deaths by suicide. Could you talk about a couple of better ways to talk about it that we might usually in the media or just in daily conversation?
Yeah, I love that you bring up language around suicide. And that is one of the things we are especially proud of in the report, including best practice language around suicide and suicide prevention. So what I'll say is that language is always evolving. So the table that we have in the report on page 9, who knows, in a year, maybe we'll hear from people with lived experience who say, you know, like, I don't know if that's actually the best way we should be talking about it. And we also know different cultural groups and, you know, different people prefer different language. So it's really about making sure we're using what people with lived experience want us to use. And so some examples of those, the easy one is the shift from saying committed suicide to saying died by or died of suicide. Committed implies a sin or a crime and furthers that stigma around suicide. I know a lot of folks are still saying committed because that's kind of what we grew up with. You know, we hear committed, it has a long history. So just being able to shift our language really helps decrease the stigma and increase people's ability to talk openly about this.
And then the phrase a failed attempt at suicide is kind of a really weird one when you start to think about it. What's a better way to talk about that?
Yeah, and we see failed or unsuccessful suicide attempt a lot in the literature too. A lot of professionals are still using failed suicide or unsuccessful suicide, but just in plain language, we can say a suicide attempt. They attempted suicide, because we don't want to say failed. It implies failure, lack of success. And there's actually a really gendered history there too, talking about, you know, if women attempt more, a lot of times those have been called failed attempts. And then when people talk in the literature about completions, males like completing suicide, that also has some connotations as well. So just trying to get rid of that gendered connotation, we just try to say suicide attempt, disclosed suicidal thoughts, a suicide or a suicide death. So using that report, the language table in the report is a really good start to start practicing language that decreases stigma.
We're talking with Leah Rolando right now, Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin, looking at ways that health professionals and everyday people can support people in need. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about suicide prevention efforts in Wisconsin? Are there changes you'd like to see? If you work in healthcare or supportive services, what's your experience been like over the years? Is it different in 2020 with everything going on? And is this an issue that's impacted you or your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Leah Rolando from Mental Health America of Wisconsin, talking about suicide prevention work here in the state. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need to see more suicide prevention efforts, mental health care opportunities, maybe in your part of the state? Are there services you think are working well for people that you think could expand? If you are a care provider in one way or another, what do you see working out there? If your family or you have been affected by a suicide in your family, What do you want people to keep in mind when they talk about these issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to get into a number of the, like you said, many recommendations in this report. A basic area of action here, increasing efforts that build connections to community, coworkers, faith leaders, and family and friends. Leah, can you talk about what that might look like and how it can help?
Sure. So already you listed a lot of options. We included those because suicide prevention can look a little bit different in each of those. So one example, we mentioned faith communities. We at the Prevent Suicide Wisconsin conference had a workshop on faith-based suicide prevention. So there's a lot of things that different faith communities can do to educate their congregations and the broader community about how to respond to people when they're in crisis or when they're dealing with whatever it is they might be dealing with. And so that can look like having discussion groups around this. There are also like groups in Wisconsin, in rural Wisconsin specifically. I'm thinking about also someone who just presented at the conference, Jeff Ditzenberger, who did a presentation on TUGS, getting farmers together to talk about just daily struggles in mental health and things that they're dealing with every day. So these aren't necessarily support groups, but they are areas where people can get together and feel a part of a community. There's also cultural groups, identity groups. So especially for students who are in junior high or high school, like school age students, of course, a lot are virtual now, but there are groups like Gay Straight Alliances or Black Student Unions, identity groups that can bring people together and make people feel affirmed and validated and welcomed for who they are. And so I think there's a lot of options in that strategy to prevent suicide.
Let our listeners know if they want to hear more about that TUGS program. We talked to Jeff Ditzenberger back in 2018. Really fascinating effort. Glad to hear it's still going on. Let's bring a caller on now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Dickeyville. John, hi.
Hi. My brother suffered from multiple sclerosis for 16 years, and he took his life in 2013. When people say committed suicide, it's not a crime, it's not a sin. But I don't think it's necessarily wrong, because the way I look at it is that he committed to ending his pain. He suffered for so long that he had made a commitment to stop, to stop it. And so, I mean, I look at it a little bit differently than the stigmatized version of it.
John, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. And Leah, you said it's got people who have experienced this and their family may have different ways of talking about it and accept different things. But I wanted to get to something that John also brings up. His brother, he said, had MS, and you list a lot of risk factors. One of them is ongoing pain or other medical conditions. Talk a little bit about that as a risk factor.
Yeah, one of the key findings in the report is that approximately one in every four people who died by suicide had a reported physical health problem that contributed to the suicide. And so we want to make sure we're not looking at just mental health. Like I said, we need to be looking at people who have, you know, physical health problems or problems outside of just what we're, you know, diagnosing as mental health issues or mental disorders. And John, you bring up a really good perspective on that language around committed, and I appreciate you bringing that.
John, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Sorry for the loss in your family. Can you talk about some other risk factors? As you said, depression and other mental health concerns are part of it. Physical health. What are some of the other things that that might lead to thinking about suicide or attempting it?
Yeah. So the more social things like a job problem, a financial problem, or legal problem, those are all risk factors. There's a lot of data in the report on those. Some of the other risk factors include intimate partner issues. And it gets as specific as talking about, for example, one of the statistics is nearly one in every five suicide deaths occurred after a recent argument or conflict. So I think some of our interventions need to address, you know, how we communicate with one another and how we do, you know, for example, social emotional learning in school, and things that target other issues outside of just mental health issues that are just very individually based.
Talking to Leah Rolando, Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator at Mental Health America of Wisconsin, looking at a new report on the impact of suicide in Wisconsin and the many opportunities to make a better climate for us, for our mental health, our well-being, our connections to others, and ways to hopefully bring down the rate of suicide and suicide attempts. Now, Leah, this report uses the latest available data. It's going through 2017. We're in 2020. And a lot of the positive factors, you know, those connections, those in-person meetings are harder to come by now. What kind of concerns do you and your colleagues have this year? I know the data is probably not there yet, but what are you watching for, worried about, and hoping we can fix it with?
Yeah, we are very concerned about increased isolation and loneliness, and folks who previously didn't have a support system, or maybe their support system was in person, and now that's just not available virtually. So we're trying to get creative in ways that we can offer virtual programs. One program I really want to talk about as an example of what other folks can do, at Mental Health America Wisconsin, we're trying to launch an LGBTQ peer support program so that can meet, it will be peers supporting other peers virtually. So across the state, you know, we're not limited by geography, and bringing together LGBTQ young people and talking about things like identity and mental health and things that could support them. And so that's one small example of something that we can do. And I know some of our suicide loss support groups across the state have also moved to virtual formats. We understand that does not replace in-person meetings, and there's much value in in-person grief support groups, but we're doing the best that we can to get creative and offer support in new ways and in some more accessible ways too. We found that being able to go virtual, people don't have the commute for one, and you're able to interact with people who might not necessarily even be in your city or town. So there are some pros. I don't want to say that, you know, it's better to be virtual, but we're all navigating this together. And I think there are still some creative ways we can connect with each other.
Now, big picture, we've talked about some different subgroups. You mentioned people in rural communities who maybe don't have a lot of mental health access, LGBTQ youth, people in cities. You have a lot of different approaches and suggestions in this report, and it sounds like that's because there's not going to be a magic wand, one size fits all, that's going to help everybody.
Right, exactly. I think that's one of the biggest messages that I would love to see more in suicide prevention, is that suicide prevention efforts and trainings are not one size fits all. We need a variety of approaches. We need community-led approaches, even if trainings are evidence-based, evidence for which populations. They may not work for all different populations, all different ages and settings. And so we need to continue to get more creative and think about a comprehensive approach that includes a lot of different communities that suicide prevention has historically left out.
In our last minute or so, Leah, do you see positive signs where we are actually taking some of these initiatives and running with them?
I think so. I think there's a lot of hope in some of the groups that are peer-led by people with lived experience of suicide. I think the more we elevate the voices of suicide attempt survivors and people who still deal with suicidal thoughts, the more we learn about what actually works. I think groups like Alternatives to Suicide.
I think we just abruptly lost our guest. Sorry about that. We've been talking to Leah Rolando, Suicide Prevention Program Coordinator with Mental Health America of Wisconsin. She talked with us about a new report looking at the impact of suicide in Wisconsin and different ways, lots of different ways to help prevent it, either maybe just before in that crisis moment, but also building a healthier community to where people don't end up considering that attempt in the first place. You can find a link to that full report. We've got it up at WPR.org /Central Time, WPR.org/Central Time. A reminder that Suicide Prevention Lifeline, it is available 24 hours a day at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK. You can also text HOPELINE to 741-741. Thanks again to our guest, Leah Rolando. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 8, find out how the COVID-19 pandemic is putting added financial stress on hospitals that serve rural areas. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next on Central Time, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk about how cooking novices can set up their first kitchens and be successful with their early cooking projects. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.